two different sets of tests and resulting specifications assigned to those tests create, I think, a very significant burden for the manufacturing community. It does introduce a level of confusion in the market as well. Which is the better test? Which mark do I trust? Which mark enables me to participate in a greater number of events? Just what does it mean? Coming from the manufacturing world myself, fragmentation is never a good thing. Never.
Welcome back to the Future of Pickleball. We really have a great show today. There's been a lot of controversy, a lot of discussion, a topic of paddle testing. Well, we're going to the source. We have Carl Schmitz, the Chief Technology Officer of USA Pickleball, with us today. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Paul. Appreciate the invite.
You know, I'm really excited about this. We all were just at an event on the 31st of January in Maryland, where USA Pickleball hosted a pickleball media day for industry people in the media side, but also a number of the manufacturers were there, and they showed us everything. And we kind of went over a lot of things. And then there was a very open, as a matter of fact, the event was scheduled to be a 8 o'clock to 12 o'clock event, and it became an 8 o'clock to 2 o'clock event because there was lots to be discussed. Before we get into the event itself, Carl, I do want to just kind of take an opportunity to talk to you a little bit about how long you have been around pickleball, where you came from before pickleball, and how you ended up being the CTO at USA Pickleball.
Sure. To address your first question, I've been involved in the sport for close to a decade. My wife and I discovered it back in 2014, early 2015. We became ambassadors for the sport for USA Pickleball in our local town, put together a very large club. We ended up working with the city to convert unused tennis courts to six pickleball courts. And we grew up a very large club at the time. Over that period of time, I became increasingly involved in the sport. I was essentially semi-retired at the time from the tech industry, and the sport offered many opportunities for my skill set. I've worked in a number of different industries over time, which I'll touch on in just a moment, but I got involved in the initial take on the rating system, got involved in the first attempt at a pro tour by the PPF in 2017. Out of that, I built a media platform and ended up streaming most of the pro events through 2019 as well, which was quite an experience. And through that that time in 2015, I joined USAP as part of a team, the Equipment Evaluation Committee, which is founded by Justin Maloof and John Anderson, who is currently our chief engineer. And at the time, volunteered in that role to inspect paddles as they were submitted. And then over the course of time, my role gradually increased to Director of Equipment Compliance and Certification. And then we added facilities development back in 2022. And then this last year, mid-year, we converted the role to CTO. The reason for that is that we wanted to start to look at other technologies that we needed to consider developing and applying to the sport, including analytics, broad scale live streaming. So example, at the last Nationals event, we had 41 courts all live streaming simultaneous with post-produced analytics available to every competitor as well. And we actually were the first to do full analytics for the broadcast as well. So I'm quite excited about adding that to our portfolio and continuing to develop that. Prior to this, as I mentioned, I've been involved in several different industries. Started life as a systems engineer, trained at Battelle Memorial Institute, which is the largest R&D entity in the U.S. They operate most of the national labs like the Renewable Energy National Lab. Battelle Northwest is where I started. And so after that, though, I moved into professional sports. I was a pro racquetball player during that sports boom years during the 80s. I moved into a club general management role for several years, learned quite a bit of what to do and what not to do. And that informs a lot of what we do in the facility space today. Following that, I was an entrepreneur for several years, a recovering entrepreneur for a short period of time. And then I moved into tech, and I spent 2.5 decades in tech, a good part of that with the largest semiconductor manufacturer on the planet, as well as a good part of that time was spent abroad. So I've had a fairly diverse background, and frankly speaking, what I do today is almost a convergence of everything I've done in the past.
One of the things that I find, and I'll always do a little bit of research on my own into the guests that I'm going to have here, and I noticed that you, in both the ASTM and the System Dynamics, you have credentials from both of those organizations, and I know a lot about that, but I don't think a lot of other people do. Tell us a little bit about what ASTM does and what Systems Dynamics does.
Of course. So ASTM is a global organization that focuses on standards. We're working in alignment with them today to develop essentially global standards for the sport. And the equivalent of this is almost like open sourcing software. And so as we work, we have been working with the ASTM standards in the past. We've been adapting them for our sport. Examples would be for ball compression, for coefficient of friction. And then most recently, we've adapted a baseball bat and ball coefficient of restitution test for a PB core, a paddle and ball core test. And so we've been adapting those tests, but this next step will be the sport, within the sport, will develop tests specifically for the sport. And in essence, those will be available for anybody to download and start work on their own paddles. And so that's a huge step towards standardization globally for the sport. So that's the ASTM side. The System Dynamics, of course, that's a very much related to the systems engineering topic that I was trained in while at Battelle. That is essentially the equivalent of a general contractor. So I'm a mile wide and an inch deep. And so a general contractor, of course, brings in specialists to address different things, architect, electrical engineer, piping, mechanical, that type of thing. In systems engineering, it's the same thing. It's looking at bringing together complex systems. There's one other credential I think is very important and related to the role that I fulfill today, and that's the Acoustical Society of America. So for the last 2 years, we've spent quite a bit of resource, time and money in research and enabling manufacturers to develop products to address one concern within the sport, and that is the acoustical footprint of the sport, the signature of the sport. And so understanding soundscapes, what can be done where it is in a sensitive area, for example, in a community park or a pocket park, it's called, what can be done to reduce the sound so that it bothers the neighbors to a lesser degree. And so those are some of the organizations that I participate in. In addition, the American Sports Builders Association, we have a very close relationship with them and all of the certified builders that are within that organization as well.
Very nice. And, you know, it's really interesting because one of the things that I, having been in the sporting goods industry, and I've been around a lot of development in standards and how sports grew and evolved, like yourself, I've been around this game a pretty long time, and I'm sort of shocked at the level of technology that's been required as we're getting into it. And that's what we're really here to talk about today. You know, one of the things that is sort of interesting to me as I look into the sport is We've had such an acceleration of population come into it. Everybody knows about that. But there's been this acceleration of knowledge and evolution and development of product that really is the thing that has kind of made everything in standards kind of catch fire. Is that not correct?
That is correct. If we were to look just 5 years ago, the type of materials, the type of manufacturing, the paddle configurations were far different than what they are today. If there had been no change, I would say that the rules and specifications that we had in place at the time would have been adequate to ensure that the paddles remained within the envelope of performance that we're trying to ensure is in place. But since then, the introduction of new materials, raw carbon fiber, and frankly, that's a molded resin surface, for example. The other materials, the different types of core materials, the introduction of foams, the introduction of thermoforming, and which is essentially a frame for the paddle, and then more recently, open throat paddles. That's something that has occurred in every sport over a period of time. You'll see over my shoulder here, early tennis rackets, early racquetball rackets as well. Those all went from single beam to dual beam type of head support, right? So with an open throat, and so we've seen that in our industry as well. And so with the introduction of these new technologies, new manufacturing processes, materials, and configurations, we've had to develop our own testing processes to keep pace with that. And like in any industry, by the way, the typical flow is, money drives the first direction, then engineering the second piece, and then governance is the third, right? And so we've tried to keep as tight as possible to that, anticipate where we could or where it makes sense. But in most cases, a paddle manufacturer may come out with something new, and we'll have to A, interpret its compliance with the existing rules. And then we also need to understand, is there something that we need to start research and development to make sure that there's the proper bounding properties put in place over time as well?
When we're getting into this conversation exactly the way I want to, where we're really able to discuss really a lot of the complexity and this and really this the state of the union right now in the game, because that's really what is important. Tell us, from your perspective, what difference does it make how paddles are tested, and what difference does standards make to the sport in kind of a global perspective?
As far as how paddles are tested, as I mentioned before, the difference today versus just a few years ago is significant. And so, with these new materials, the paddles would have been tested a few years ago using direct methods, or sorry, indirect methods. And what I mean by that is, in order to control spin, we tested for roughness. In order to control power, we tested for deflection. Those are indirect tests. But given the nature of paddles, introduced back in late 24, the first power paddle started to come, excuse me, late 23, the first power paddles came out, and then early 24, we started to see an increasing number of those. That basically triggered development, R&D of a test for power, which is a paddle ball coefficient of restitution test. I'm quite proud of the fact that we were able to launch that process and land on a test procedure, and then basically socialize the numbers, the process, and propose numbers to the ecosystem to start discussing just where should we be. This wasn't made in a vacuum or in an insular manner. We enrolled support from the manufacturers, from players as well, to help us determine where that threshold should be, and then we developed a policy to be able to apply that over time. So this was a very complex process that we went through. Just to put it in perspective, basically defining the process and specification, rolling out the policy, all of that took under 9 months. And I would say developing the actual test itself and the target number for that was done in 6 months. To put that in perspective, back in the early 70s, Werner Fischer rolled out a configuration of a tennis racket called it was called spaghetti string at the time. I've got the patent in back of me here on the wall, just as a reminder. This is more or less a not only a museum in back of me, but also a cautionary tale. And so it took the ITF 6 years to actually reach a decision on whether or not to allow the continuance of that paddle con or racket configuration at the time. And in the end, they ended up banning that typical or that specific configuration. At the same time, by the way, Howard Head introduced and patented the large headed prince, which I also have back here as well. And that one remained in the industry, and of course, really changed the nature of tennis to a huge degree. And so, the point I'm trying to make is that those decisions and the responses to those by a governing body are critical to the health of the sport. The ability to respond as quickly as possible, make decisions that are related to it, and ensure ongoing compliance is also it's complex, it's sensitive in many cases, and something that isn't taken lightly by USAP.
Yeah, no, and it one of the reasons that I'm so personally passionate about this whole subject of governance is the standpoint that every one of those paddles, including the spaghetti, I actually played with. I was in the tennis world. I saw the whole evolution of everything that went on in the tennis world and the controversies that went along with it. I wasn't real involved with racquetball, but I know that they had tremendous challenges that came out of technological, I guess from my observation, a little out of control that ended up, I think, significantly hurting the sport. Those are really all the reasons that I think we're sitting here today. I want to take a quick pause though and ask those of you that are watching this, if you like the content of what we're doing, hit the like button. Subscribe to my show. That's how we get more and more people understanding what kind of information is available and how they can see it readily. And at the end of the day, I want to say, it really matters to us. Hit the notification button. You'll see these things the minute they come out, and you'll know everything that's going on. Now, let's go back to the specifics of January 31st and the media day. The first question I want to ask, because it came up a little bit in some of the responses from some of the people in attendance, who was invited, and from the people that were invited, who showed up? And we don't have to get into all the specifics of every brand, but what was the strategy for USA Pickleball on that?
Sure. There were basically two constituencies that we looked at. One, of course, was the media. The invitations consisted of those within the traditional journalism background, so those from print and online media. In addition to that, though, looking at something that's we're really seeing significant trends of in this sport, and that is social media. And so podcasters like yourself. There are quite a few, and there are more, it seems, every week. If you just follow it on YouTube, and you'll see that. So we felt it was important. We do monitor those, and we saw, quite a broad mix of reporting styles, of the type of facts and information that's used in those broadcasts. And we felt it was important to give visibility to our testing processes. To our approach to governance, a general overview of what USA Pickleball does within this sport, and to grow this sport to, at grassroots levels. Our goal is to grow it from the 19 million that are out there today, to continue to drive and grow it, whether directly or indirectly. And so we felt it very important to get those voices out there in the media in our lab, just to show that we felt it's the right place, it's the right people, and the right processes that we have in place for testing. We felt it was a great opportunity. There have been a number of manufacturers as well that have expressed interest in replicating our lab. And so for those manufacturers that had voiced that interest to us and wanted to see firsthand the equipment up close and personal, some of them had been there before, but we were also doing a walkthrough and presentation on the software and hardware being used in our spin rate test development as well. And so that was the nature of those manufacturers that were invited. They had expressed an interest in replicating the lab. So that's why it was a subset, a little bit different than our industry day that we host either it's generally an annual event that we host at the labs, and we'll usually get 20 to 30 on site, plus another 100 or so online that follow that. And with that, we go through a walkthrough on the testing processes, development, and what the roadmap looks like going forward. So this had a slightly different flavor and a slightly different mix of attendees.
So and all of those were the reasons that I was anxious to be there and sort of see it, where I'm not in the paddle testing. I don't really get involved with that. I'm really kind of take a little more of a business to business overview from the people that I interview. But standards in the sport are becoming such a critical piece. And as our sport is growing globally, I've been at a couple of international events now, and it's the hot topic from all of these foreign countries. They need to know what to do. They're looking for direction and guidance. So that's why I was there. And I'll just tell everybody, when we got there, it was a wonderful event. They kicked it off. They introduced it. We got a beautiful tour of all of these facilities. And I'll tell you, you can find so many of the different reviews that were done where they videoed and they recorded. All of that stuff is readily available now online, and we're going to kind of talk about some of the behind-the-scenes conversations that happened at the event that I thought were pertinent, given the fact that we were all there together at the event. We all saw the conversation, heard the discussion, and then the podcast come out after that, and I thought it was a good opportunity to give you a chance to kind of review some of that stuff and give us your input after the fact. Did I cover it reasonably accurately?
Yes.
So then after that was done, the real heart of the event that I thought was really positive was it was an open forum to discuss all of the different ideas. And there were a number of hot topics, if you will, that came up in this that were talked about and now have been reported on very heavily from the podcast marketplace. But my list of them, so we'll just, if you don't mind, we'll kind of go along, is one of the things that came up was a pretty detailed analysis of how the handle is held in the bracket for the cannon to hit it, and does that create a variable environment? And there's been some criticism that there wasn't a standard to that. How do you respond to that from your side of the technology of that?
Yeah, the initial piece is that we built the test as closely as possible to as a derivative of the ASTM test for bat and ball. There's a clamp that's used, and the typical paddle teardown reveals in most cases a stiff grip. So there's the blade of the core itself, almost like a tang of a nice knife blade. And then there are the pallets on either side that essentially complete the octagonal shape of a grip. What we do is for the PB core test is we unwrap the grip, we take off the butt cap, and then it's held in a clamp that's essentially been designed for a relatively rigid blade and pallet type combination. There are some paddles out there that have softer materials on either side of the tang of the paddle blade itself or the core. And there was some concern that there may be issues with that providing a firm handshake between the paddle and the clamp itself. We're looking into that to ensure that there is no basis of concern. No change in terms of the result of a paddle that has that alternate configuration. There are not a lot of paddles like that. There are a few, though, and so we're ensuring that the process does address that. If there's shimming required, then that would be done. Our initial view on that is that there is no issue with it, though. So we're very confident that we're seeing consistent results from the test and the fixtures that are used for the test and the existing configuration that we have.
Yeah, and now then the next subject, and I think there was a lot of understanding of the variable in the ball and how you chose the ball to use for the PB core test. Kind of take us through why you did it. But also, I'll come back to where some of the discussion went on the ball itself, but tell us how you guys arrived at your standard.
Of course. And so uh, I When we launched this, the R&D relative to PB Core, one of the first things that our chief engineer, John Anderson, looks to do when working with the sports engineering practice at Element is to understand what are the potential elements of variance that need to be eliminated. And the very first one is that this ball has holes in it, which immediately create variance in terms of its response or interaction with the paddle once it's shot out and it strikes it. There have been a number of different numbers on this, but it can be up to 10% that needs to be addressed from a correction. And that's you'll see that in some of the commentary in the market that others are looking at doing this type of test. And they apply a correction factor of about 10%. That's significant. And so because this is not a test for the ball, this is a test for the paddle. And so reducing any potential source of variation was a key area of focus. And in that case, what we did is we came up, we use a conventional ball, but it's not drilled. And so we reduce that source of variation by using a solid sphere. And with that, we developed a test that consistently delivers results in terms of the impact and then the return off the ball itself. And so that was a key area of focus, is that we need to reduce all sources of variation to the greatest extent possible. And that was a pretty straightforward one, to be frank. And given the results, we've got both a very accurate and repeatable test and repeatable results as well. And so we've seen that in the hundreds of paddles that we've tested since launching the program, that the results are very, very repeatable, very consistent from paddle to paddle. And even when returning and looking at a paddle again, we'll see the same set of results. So we're quite pleased with the result there.
Now, one of the things, and this was a point of, even though we'll come back to the paddle itself, but in the ball, there was a lot of questioning of the fact that is a ball without holes in it still a real world application, as opposed to, well, all the balls that we play with have holes in them. And there was a lot of discussion about the hemisphere and the polarization or the poles of the ball, and whether you do it differently or how you address that or how you see it as a variable.
Yeah. So the good news is that there are no poles to worry about here, right? And so with that, from a hemispheric standpoint, we don't need to worry about making adjustments or applying any type of correction to that correction formula. And so the initial results we get are accurate. The rebound off the face of the paddle is accurate, and then we've got again all the data that shows that it's a very repeatable test. That's the most important thing. And when we're talking, when people say, "Well, what's the real world there?" We are talking about a non-dimensional number, right? It's a ratio. Inbound speed versus outbound speed, with some adjustments made for moment of inertia, et cetera. And so to that end, it's a number. And so for the man on the street, whether it's a 43 or 44, everything's relative. If it's higher, if the 44 is higher than the 43, they know that the energy returned off the face of the paddle is greater. What that 44 or 45 means when they bounce a ball off the paddle, it's a non-dimensional figure, right? And so it that piece of it doesn't matter as much as the consistency and repeatability of the test.
And it's interesting. You're mentioning a couple of things, and I've watched and rewatched a number of the podcasts trying to make sure that I was getting an accurate capture of what some of the topics of discussion were. When you were presenting, and I don't remember whether it's you or John were presenting the ball in discussion, is the non-hold ball, is that something that would be available to anybody that wanted to get them to mirror the test, or is that something that they would have to get through you, or is that available?
They are available through USAP. They just need to contact us at equipment@usapickleball.org. and
All right, good.
let us know how many they'd need.
You know, one of probably the hottest, most controversial subject was talking about destructive testing, because where we've had challenges in the sport with inaccurate paddle results or I don't want to quite say cheating, but I'll say cheating of figuring out how to get around the rules, and a destructive test could be a solution to that. Why don't you explain to people what a destructive test is and would do, and what destruction to advantage would be?
Of course. Yeah, the term is degrade to benefit. And so that's something that there is a significant concern about that. And we are concerned with that, certainly. The challenge in fatigue testing or life cycle testing is that virtually every configuration of paddle will yield a different life cycle curve, depending on the adhesives used, the core construction, core thickness, facial plies, the number of facial plies. Is it a thermoformed or cold press type paddle as well? So there's a myriad of different designs, right, that yield different life cycle curves. The conventional curve from paddles that were manufactured years ago would be just a nice long soft curve, and so you could be playing with this paddle for, you know, a year or 2 years, and it would more or less feel the same to you. It might be a little bit softer, and really you may not even notice the difference until you pick up a brand new one. But the difference there is that those paddles, the core, the adhesive, and the facial plies would all degrade, you know, with some soft curve. More recently, in early 23, the first thermoform paddles came out from a cluster of manufacturers, and I believe all of them came from the same supplier upstream. And those demonstrated an issue where the core crushed very quickly, and essentially it was a degrade to benefit. It was, though, a catastrophic failure. It wasn't designed in. It was a result of any number of different reported issues, whether it was adhesive or the raw materials were not cut to spec. And so there are a number of issues. At the time, rather than taking a position of saying all thermoform paddles are bad, we developed and implemented a test, a field test for the pro tours that allowed a test in place at courtside to understand if there were core integrity issues. It was using a mature technology, an ultrasonic bond tester, and it worked very well in terms of capturing that issue. And so that was a key area of focus and the first real indication of degrade to benefit. More recently, last year, we saw a couple of occasions where paddles were actually designed to break down quickly, with tubes running down the middle, down the vertically or north-south through the paddle that would crush almost instantly and yield a much more active facial ply. And that's really what happens is, if the core gets crushed quickly, or if components within the core break down quickly, then the surface plies are far more free to move and deliver more energy. And so the concern there is that paddle manufacturers may be developing paddles that do have a very short breakdown period and significant breakdown period, which will yield a much faster paddle. The initial thoughts on that have been, well, why don't you test in the lab? And John and I and the other experts in the field have had several conversations about this. You know, is that practical? The challenge there relates back to what I mentioned a few minutes ago. The wide variety of configurations would mean any number of different life cycle tests would need to be developed. Is it 1,000 hard strikes? Is it 1,500? Well, then it raises the question, once we put a stake in the ground and say it's 1,500, well, then the paddle may be designed to break down after 2,000. That's the first issue. The second is, that is a technical issue. You know, where do you draw the line? How do you test for that? And is it an accurate representation of normal use of a paddle? The second is more or less philosophical, and that is, Do you, a manufacturer, want us telling you what the life cycle is of your paddle? There are paddle manufacturers that intentionally develop very durable paddles and issue a lifetime warranty for the paddle and materials and build quality. There are others that may just as soon you buy a new paddle every 6 months. And so they may design it to break down more quickly. And so again, our position there is that testing products like that and from a durability standpoint really falls on the manufacturer's shoulders. And that's a philosophical position. The last piece is, even if we did have life cycle testing in the labs upfront for certification, that doesn't mean that there might not be changes made to the design in the field. And that was a theme, an unfortunate theme that was brought up, and that is a manufacturer can make a change later on. And we've seen that. That's happened in the past, and we've been able to capture that through market compliance and field compliance programs, which I hope we have the chance to talk about in a few minutes. But in general, all the testing up front that could be developed won't matter if something has changed downstream. And we've seen occurrences of that in some of the decertifications that we made last year. And so that's a very, very important point. I will bring up, we're not just waving it off, though. We acknowledge the concern, and if you recall in the meeting, we did take a position that we would evaluate potential tests that could be done there. But for those reasons that I've stated at the lab for certification, but for the reasons I've stated, we feel there's a better approach to this, which is very similar to what's done in table tennis by the ITTF and is done in baseball by the NC2A and a number of other organizations. And that's ramping up field testing. And so we're evaluating a number of platforms that'll allow us to scale in that area and test much deeper into the draws and tournament competitions, not just the pros, but also amateur ranks, but also to enable other tournament directors and clubs to start testing on site as well, to ensure that paddles that do break in. That there is a view toward, is it a degrade to benefit, or is it just a natural breakdown in terms of the components within the paddle? I'll take a beat there.
You know, and this was a and anybody that wants to go and look online at the different podcast reviews that other podcasters did, there was a very, very strong position by the podcasters, I thought in general, to, well, this has to be USA Pickleball's responsibility for this degradation testing. And from my background in the sports industry for a long, long time, manufacturers always had this agree that they would comply, that the product worked for the lifetime of the product. And if we don't start there, doesn't it automatically build in the idea of, okay, I only have to be responsible at the beginning because it's up to them to catch me before, you know, we have a consequence. And so the idea of how manufacturer responsibility of you provide the product to us and you understand that that has to comply through the lifetime of the product seemed to me to be a very obvious and natural position. And yet it wasn't from many of the other players. And that got to be a long, controversial discussion. What was your take on that?
Yeah, I'd have to say that I do understand some of the paddle testers, those that are in the podcasting segment, that do test samples that are sent to them from manufacturers. They experience this breakdown or break-in period, and they have a strong opinion related to that, and that might be based on, well, where's the best place to capture this? I also understand that very few of them have backgrounds in manufacturing. And so that's a key thing to understand is that there are certain things that can be controlled at the point of manufacture from a quality standpoint, whether it's quality control or near-term quality assurance as well, and whose responsibility is that. From a governing standpoint, you set the bar at a certain level on what your expectations are for a performance envelope from a given product. But when you introduce something that is wildly variable, like the expected life cycle of a paddle and how will it be used, how do you actually set a standard for that? And I understand that you know, they may not, some of the podcasters may not have experience in that space, you know, so that's a situation where we hope that open dialogue in that case, at the media day, ongoing interactions with them, we can help them understand what the basis of a certification is, how important market compliance is, field compliance. Those are two different things and conducted in different ways, how important those are as well. And that we're not designing this for new. We're looking at learnings in other sports. This is how it's done in baseball. This is how it's done in table tennis, golf to some extent as well. These tests are done in the field, and that may help bound any player-induced or introduced changes to the paddle. Or if that paddle, if we see increasing incidence of breakdown within a given model, then we have the discussion with the manufacturer and say, look, we've got a concern with the design of your paddle. And it is up to the manufacturer, though, to understand what the failure modes may be in their product. And so, or just the degradation curve on it. And so they need to factor that into their performance characteristics when they build the product. And so if the limit is at 44, and it comes in at 42, but has a degrade to benefit, it needs to stay below the 44, and then it will deteriorate over time. If they come in at 44 and it degrades to benefit to 46, that's an issue. And so,
right. I really was caught a little bit off guard because I've been involved with a lot of product development in my life, and it was always, everything was always a matter of, well, how do we comply with what the industry standard is? And it wasn't, and there's been such a propensity to how do we skirt the issue, I think is, and that's my opinion. Let's just say, we'll just leave that there. That's my opinion, that there's been some cheating and skirting of the issues because they thought they could get away with it. And that it really, the industry has to take the position, not just USA Pickleball. I've heard many of the podcasters talk about reviewing different paddles that they've got. And they're very clearly talking about, oh, man, wait till you see how hot it gets. There was just a podcast that was out in the last day or two talking about a new brand that's setting out information about your paddle has a lifetime. It's got a starting point, a break-in point, and an end of life point. And there's so that's obviously there in my argument, or the thing that I wish more of these people would consider, is the fact that if a manufacturer can be sophisticated enough to create the degradation to advantage, they also ought to be able to figure out how not to have it degrade beyond compliance. And that's why I take that position. But I don't think it's an absolute that it's only up to the manufacturers and you have no responsibility. But I think that the idea of not starting with the manufacturer has to understand that that's it. Because then the podcasters, if they find themselves working, talking about a product that they find out isn't really approved, but they've been told it was, boy, now we're all kind of working in the same direction as to how to solve the problem.
Sure. Yeah, there's two components to what you're talking about there. The first component it's an unfortunate topic of conversation, and that is a question of integrity within the manufacturing community. And this was, you know, heard loud and clear that concern is increasing. To address that, we're putting in place, we're ramping up a number of compliance programs, both at the market side in terms of increasing sampling out there on paddles off the shelf to ensure that they are built as tested. And then the second is the field compliance program that I outlined by increasing the number of events and the depth of field in terms of testing for compliance there as well, with a subset of tests. And I'm very excited about where we're headed there, and we'll do some updates on that very soon. The second piece of your question, and that was concerns for design up front. And whether or not they're actually following the rules, or if they're, you know, if there's a clever design, you know, that's intended to skirt. You know, of course, we have issue with that as well. We do have a process today where a manufacturer does disclose core materials. They attest to the fact it's not a design that delivers a trampoline effect. And that's been there for quite some time. We now have a as measured by applied to that same rule. So it's not a new rule with PB Core, but it's basically a, now we have an objective test and measurement to reinforce or to enforce that 2E6F ruling. And so we're pleased with the changes made, you know, at the point of certification. Is it enough to capture anything that might be done out there by a manufacturer from a design standpoint? I think a combination of the tests that we're doing today, we now X-ray every paddle to ensure what's been attested to is correct in terms of core materials. And by the way, that's called a delegation of authority, but we're relying less on that over time. And so as our tests increase in sophistication, breadth and depth, as well as our market compliance and field compliance programs, we believe that there's there are enough points in this flow to address those concerns for integrity. And we're scaling up, I think, where it needs to be done.
And so, yeah, it was interesting and frankly, very impressive to look at that X-ray machinery that you've got there and see how clearly the core crushing was obviously visible. And I'm guessing prior to that, you've had to completely cut a paddle or take it apart or something in that order, which has got to be a very different challenge.
Yeah, we've got boxes of paddles that we have done teardowns on, you know, at our compliance lab. But to your point, the CT and X-ray processes have afforded us a chance to A, give immediate feedback. Also, there's another component to this, and that is some suppliers upstream have had issues with raw materials. For example, putting a 16.5 millimeter core in a 16 millimeter form. And so the paddles are essentially pre-crushed, and that is immediately visible to us through the X-ray process. It's very visible, and we can give that feedback to the manufacturer that, hey, you've sent us bad samples. You need to push back and see what your recourse is for your supplier. And so there's some things that we're doing and working, you know, not just as a gatekeeper, but also giving feedback to manufacturers on some of the things that they may not have visibility to as well. Not all of them have their own in-house R&D, their own in-house manufacturing. They may rely on the quality control and integrity of suppliers upstream. And so we're doing what we can to inspect what we expect, but we're certainly doubling down on the verify side of the trust and but verify.
Perfect. Well, we've covered this particular group of subjects. One of the things that came up in this was at the end of the day, you guys had put a lot of work and effort into this. You put on a very nice event. What's your take now that the podcast have been out? You've seen the reporting. We all were sat in the room. What is your assessment of how it went and how you might do it? Additional ones in the future.
I've looked through, listened to, you know, the most of the results from that, and I would say that there's a mix, you know, a mix of responses to those, but you know, which means, you know, some I felt were accurate representations, you know, of a an open dialogue. You know, we took a position that this wasn't a lecture. It was essentially an ask me anything, and we addressed every question that was presented to us. We did take a fairly firm but well-informed, from an experience standpoint, position on where we felt we needed to look at the degrade to benefit issue, rather than, you know, coming in with a preconceived position. You know, we had dialogue about it and talked it through to a great extent. In general, you know, positive. I think it was is something that we would repeat. In all likelihood, because of the technical nature of some of the manufacturers that were there, it may have been a bit too deep a dive in some cases. given the varied backgrounds of some of the podcasters and journalists that were there. I think for the next occasion, we'd like to just make it a journalist only. I think, by the way, though, for those that were there, having firsthand access to some of the manufacturers and talking to them and getting and hearing their opinions, I think was also, while there was some risk taking on our part to do that, I think it was, there was a positive result in that. But in general, I think we'd like to see a larger group next time. I'm hoping that, the journalists, I'd like to get some of the traditional media there as well, to see just what we do. And it continues to evolve. I'm very excited about developments related to the spin rate test. It's a very sophisticated hardware and software platform that we're bringing to bear here. It's a dual camera solution. It's an automated process to evaluate the ball through what's called 6 degrees of freedom. And so it's not just a single camera, single axis measurement. It looks at it from two angles and looks at there's basically a 3x3 matrix that we look at from a performance and movement of the ball in three-dimensional space. And the results from that so far have been very positive. And it is an automated process, so it's not subject to human error and counting frames and doing something like that type of approach with a single camera and the off-the-shelf software. So we're quite excited about that, and I imagine that once we have that in place, I'd like to see us do a follow-up media day for that.
Good. You're mentioning something to me that was, I think it's worth mentioning here is one of the podcasters in attendance. We didn't find out till after he put his podcast together, had just come from his own tour of the UPAA plant, and in his podcast was talking about they have some different methodologies. So they have different speed on the cannon. They have different angle of incidence on the spin test. Given the fact that you're in a very sophisticated testing center, and that looked like it was a very sophisticated testing center, and when you have two different ASTM centers, let's say, and you come up with different methodologies, is there a middle ground that's found in that, or does one example showcase positives or negatives to another? How do those two different sets of information affect the sport?
Well, I'll address the latter part of your question first because that is a significant concern. The two different sets of tests and resulting specifications assigned to those tests create, I think, a very significant burden for the manufacturing community. It does introduce a level of confusion in the market as well. Which is the better test? Which mark do I trust? Which mark enables me to participate in a greater number of events? Just what does it mean? And so, coming from the manufacturing world myself, and also from the sports management and as a an athlete back in the day, fragmentation's never a good thing, never. And so, now to answer the first part of your question, the takeaways that I have from that is that the reducing the sources of variation, that's a key thing that our engineering staff and the sports engineering practice at Element focus on as a primary point, right, as they put the test together. And so the addressing the both the coefficient of restitution as well as spin rate using the solid ball, that's a huge contributor to repeatability and consistency in the testing. What we've done with that is that now we've got a very reliable test, and we don't need to apply any type of correction factor to it. So all the precision and accuracy in the world up front doesn't matter if you have to make some type of correction because of that source of variability. In this case, the ball with holes in it. So that's a significant part. On the angle of attack or the incident angle for spin rate, we'll more than likely land on the same number. It's an angle that engages all components of the paddle, right? So one of the things that we've not addressed when using looking at coefficient of friction or surface roughness is dwell. The amount of time that the ball spends on the paddle face means it can engage with whatever texture is there, which can then impart additional spin. And so I think the selection of the angle will be very important. And that's the next, as the our lab builds up its hardware and software platform, its testing fixture, we'll go through that last mile. Now, the bigger picture, to answer your question, is I would like to see us come together with the other entity to evaluate what are some of the best practices. Are there areas that we should converge that do make sense? And it's not because we're the sports governing body. It's because it's the right thing to do for the manufacturers. It's the right thing to do for the market. That's the reason to find this area of convergence. And I'd like to say that, you know, I hope we can get to the table to have the conversation that, hey, let's compare notes on the engineering side first. What's feasible? Mm-hmm. What makes sense? Why did you go this direction? And once we have, some better understanding of that, then the next step can be addressed as well, because there are other elements of this that relate to the business model, you know, and the funding models of the respective entities as well that need to, those are part of the decision making, you know, related to it. But back to my initial point, fragmentation is bad, and the ripple effect, the impact in the manufacturing community and on the market is significant, and we'd like to do everything possible to reduce that.
Well, and that's good. I was really pleased to see, and since that event, I've heard from a couple of different manufacturers that I know that are looking at putting in the repeatable testing model that you are. And I think that that'll be just fabulous, because we start to get to a point that where the rubber meets the road is what is repeatable. How can we run a test, you know, take a paddle standard and say, let's compare it to different tests. All of that should lead back to that unification and lack of disruption in the sport, which I think will be great. I did want to ask you one very specific technical question that no one has been able to answer this for me, and I hope you have some insight. With the speeding up of paddles, it scares me to death, not from a personal injury standpoint, but from an injury to the sport, that if we start having incidents of people being injured in the face because they're 14 feet apart from an opponent that's hitting a ball, has there been any testing or any data collected on what the human reflex component is at how much speed can overcome human reflexes?
The answer to the latter part of your question, I don't think any research has been done there, because that's a high level of variability to that. The answer to the first part of your question is, personally, I've done quite a bit of analysis on this in the past because of the hundreds of hours of footage that I have using a kitchen cam, essentially, which allows basically an analysis of ball speed and from paddle to paddle at the kitchen. And what I've seen is anything from a third of a second to a quarter of a second is the probably the least reaction time, the lowest reaction time during a shootout. And that's equivalent, by the way, to the world's fastest pitch and to the world's fastest first serve in tennis. The difference in our sport, of course, is that there's another one and another one and another one. It's not just a one off, right? And so we're not seeing a huge, at present, a huge incident. Incidents of injuries related to that yet, but there has been over the last year an overarching concern for the direction of that. As far as the personal, you know, what is the terminal velocity? What's the speed, you know, that a person cannot respond to? When I'm on, a quarter of a second's fine. When I'm off, a third of a second's too fast, right? So there's that variable that we need to look at as well. So there's not been a number established, Paul, but the key point I think to you is that to make to you is that we recognize in general that speed up does that increasing speed does and has had a potential impact on safety, although there's not a number related to that. And it certainly has had an impact on what we believe to be the true nature of the sport, and that's one of finesse. And so that's why, after developing the test protocols and agreeing to with the industry what the thresholds should be, we implemented essentially a de-escalation policy. So as of November 1 last year, the paddles needed to be tested to below 44. As of November 1 in 2020, in this year, 2025, paddles will need to be below 43. So it gives the manufacturers a chance to meet those new numbers over time, to develop new products and meet those new targets. And what that new target in 2025, at the end of this year, November, will enable any consumer to use that paddle in over a period of the full life cycle of the paddle, because the now that the new paddle has been PB Core certified south of 43.43, then we believe it, you know, it will be at a level that will be acceptable for the ongoing future. And so there's extends the life cycle of those products that are tested to that level.
All right. The last subject that I want to talk with Carl Schmitz about is there's a new industry organization for manufacturers called PEMA, the Pickleball Equipment Manufacturers Association. I've spent the last week kind of gathering this, the most up-to-date information that I can find. And what it looks like to me is that there is a strong effort, and there's now a legal firm has been hired to put together the standards, the structure of the corporation, the things necessary for manufacturers to come together. I guess my question to you is, do you think that a governance, a manufacturers association that is a single point of contact of when you guys are needing to talk to somebody, you're able to talk directly to somebody that represents most of the manufacturers from a communication standpoint? How do you look at how that will potentially factor into this whole equation of pickleball standards management?
We do believe that a manufacturers association like that can be beneficial. I mean, we have felt that way for quite some time. In fact, the Sports and Fitness Industry Association launched a Pickleball Manufacturers Council last year. We would present to this council once a quarter. That started, in fact, they attended our industry day on May 20 in 2024. And that's essentially, it was a Q2 that they kicked off that council. We met with them in August. We met with them face-to-face at Nationals 3 months later. And we've kept up a consistent communications dialogue with them. That function of aggregating inputs from a wide variety of manufacturers, not just the large ones, but lots of smaller SMEs belong to that as well. We believe there's value in that. Rather than one-to-many from our side, having an entity that's relatively neutral, by the way, aggregate those inputs and communicate that to us in a way that's digestible, that's been very beneficial, actually. And so PEMA is not unlike that. I haven't yet seen the charter, if it's that much different than what the SFIA's Pickleball Manufacturers Council does, maybe they'll be integrated in the future. But we do see value in that and hearing one voice. There's no issue with that. And by the way, the consistent message we're getting from that one voice is one standard, one set of standards.
Sure. Yeah. And I think in other segments of the sporting goods business that I've been involved with, the Manufacturing Industry Association always was very critical because they ultimately became kind of the manager of the ethics in the sport. It's when you join our organization, there is an ethical standard that our organization wants to support in the sport itself. And then the other thing is that I think that we're beginning to see some reasonably problematic issues with counterfeiting of product, bringing out products that look like you should know what they are and they aren't. And so it seems to me that we need some kind of an ability to manage that.
Yeah, that relates back to a point I made earlier, and that is we're ramping up efforts in market compliance and field compliance. I spoke most directly about field compliance, ramping up testing in, you know, at courtside, essentially. Looking at a suite of tools to be able to enable much deeper testing within the draws, many more tournaments in the future. On the market compliance side, that will now include not only deeper sampling across the board, but also essentially enforcement of application and use of our seal. And so there have been issues, many issues where, for example, if you go onto Amazon or Alibaba or Temu and do a search on pickleball paddles, you'll see many manufacturers claiming to have been tested and certified that have not. So that's a significant issue, and we're investing in essentially a platform to audit those. In addition to that, for those existing manufacturers, we're also double checking to make sure that all of the paddles that are being sold and marketed as tested have been so. And so there's basically two thrusts. One is looking at the manufacturing community that we know, and then those outside the tent, we'd like to audit those and ideally bring them inside.
And likewise with you guys trying to protect and manage your brand and seal, it's getting to be pretty crazy. Most of the major brands in the marketplace are being knocked off on their brand and then the quality of product that's there. And it's amazing to have, you know, have a product show up in a warranty claim that you go, we don't have the faintest idea in the world what this is or where this came from, but they're out there. And I don't think until we get an industry group that then where the people are buying their, having their paddles manufactured, they're insisting that those upstream manufacturers are complying with the rules and governance, or they won't do business with them in the future. And so, no, that's a good one for me. Is there anything in this in-depth conversation that we've had, anything that you I didn't cover or you'd like to express, or did we get it all?
We covered a wide variety of topics. I appreciate the chance to deep dive on our testing, the R&D, application of policy, and what we're doing further downstream as well. As I mentioned before, compliance and certification, dealing with issues related to quality control and quality assurance, they're very, very complex in many cases. And in almost all cases, they're sensitive. In the past, we have addressed those occurrences of quality control issues where a paddle in market was different than that that was certified. We've handled those discreetly and in confidence with the manufacturer to basically address whatever the issues might have been, from a quality standpoint. In most cases, the issue would be limited to a definable lot, and so the exposure and the population out in the market was not significant. In some cases, though, if we couldn't land on a number, if it wasn't clear from a configuration control standpoint when the cutover was made, or they can't identify when a new peel ply was implemented, in those cases we've had to look at a full decertification. I think it's important to know, for your viewers to know that we have heard the concerns for lack of transparency. Everybody has a different definition for what they expect to learn from our engagements with manufacturers. Our commit there is that we will disclose additional data in the future on the nature of a decertification. The not having disclosed that in the past, while that did protect the manufacturer, it has hurt USA Pickleball. And so in the future, we will be more transparent in terms of the nature of a technical issue or a quality control issue. And so that's a key step forward for us. I think it's important for consumers to understand that. It's important for manufacturers to understand that as well, that Quality and consistency to what is certified is very important.
Yeah, the you really struck on an important theme that goes back to one of my earlier comments, and that was manufacturers have to realize that they have the financial burden of their product, of the design and development of it, and they have the financial responsibility to make sure that their product stays in compliance, because it's not up to you to be the bad guy. If we go into this thing where manufacturers realize that it is, when they get caught, there's going to be a serious punishment. One of the manufacturers that was there made a very strong and a compelling case for the fact that how do I compete in a marketplace with my product and I'm staying in the rules and somebody's having more success selling product because they cheated? And that's an interesting dynamic that I think can only be handled by the manufacturers having to understand it is their responsibility to follow the standard.
Yeah, an additional point on that as well, Paul. We heard that loud and clear that there are concerns within the manufacturing community for integrity across their peers, and there have been considerable number of new entrants each year, new to manufacturing, new to the sport. The rising tide has lifted all in this case, and so we're very very aware that this is an increasing concern. Also, the revenue impact toward a situation like you've just described can be significant. And so, we also heard that there would be an acceptance of penalties far beyond, well beyond, for example, a decertification. That's not severe enough when perhaps millions have been lost to someone that does work around the rules, or they have a loophole or testing exploit that they've developed. And so we've tried to respond quickly to those in the past. We will do so in the future. But to the point of penalties of some kind, whether it's probation or a ban of all new products or monetary, we're working on that.
Good. Carl, I want to thank you for coming. I want to also thank Selkirk TV for allowing me to have this platform to meet with people of Carl's caliber. If you don't subscribe to the Selkirk TV app, you're doing yourself a disservice. There's more great information on that app, and it's free, than you'll find anywhere else in the industry. Carl Schmidt, thank you very much. I sure enjoyed it. I'll stay in touch, and I'm anxious to see where this all goes.
I appreciate the opportunity, Paul. Thank you.